Good afternoon, Matt.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm here at the New America Foundation. You're here also, but you don't actually work here. And why don't you introduce yourself?
My name's Matthew Continetti, and I'm associate editor of the Weekly Standard and editor of our new campaign blog, The Campaign Standard. Also, a few years ago, I wrote a book called The K Street Gang, and it's very nice, Mark, to be in the New America Foundation offices with you here. It's a nice space you guys have here. So.
Yeah, well, it's a little scattered, so we're not even on the same floor. But I've been a big fan of your writing, and particularly about the honesty and straightforwardness of your writing about the K Street Gang was very, very impressive to me. And I'm a sometime blogger, columnist for the American Prospect, various other things. But I thought we'd do today. Normally, I like to make sure there's some high-minded discussion of policy or some entertaining discussion of popular culture or something like that. But what I think we should do here today is, horse race, politics, and nothing else.
Absolutely.
I think it's a good moment to do it, as everything seems to be taking shape. I keep looking at the race. I always have had this theory that, it's usually right around the first of the year that you kind of see what's actually happening in the presidential race.
Right.
And kind of take shape. Like in 2004, January 1st was when Dean just dropped. And there's some moment where what's happening really takes shape. And you knew it wouldn't be January 1st this year because that's just, 2 days before the Iowa caucus. But I've sort of been wondering, when is it? What's the day that the turn happens and the actual race begins? Which is not to say the results, but the kind of basic shape of it begins to take hold. And I think December 10th was probably about that point. So here we are. I think we'll try to keep this a little shorter than some recent Blogging Heads episodes that I've been involved in, that have gone on to Castro lengths. And just do talk about the Republicans, talk about the Democrats, talk about the Republicans. And why don't you start by talking about your impressions of the Democrats at the snapshot of time?
Absolutely.
And then we'll talk about that and go on to the Republicans.
Well, I guess the fundamental story on the Democratic side of the race, Mark, is Hillary fading and fading fast. Barack Obama has been tied for or in the lead in many Iowa polls. He's also surging in New Hampshire. He's surging in South Carolina. And those national numbers still hold an advantage for Hillary, but even those, I suspect, will start closing pretty rapidly. So the main story here is a fading Hillary, and that has caused, you read the news, you read some of these B-level politics stories within the campaign, you see a lot of turmoil inside Hillary land, a lot of division in between Senator Clinton's advisors, who tend to be women, and former President Clinton's advisors, who tend to be the guys. And as one of my bloggers on the Campaign Standard put it the other day, he smells the whiff of Cajun spices in the air. So there may be a chance that the man from Louisiana himself, James Carville, may be brought on the Hillary Clinton campaign sometime in January 2008.
Well, that's an interesting bit of rumor, although I'm not sure that I would divide it as Bill advisors versus Hillary advisors, because it seems the one story I've been sort of obsessed with Mark Penn, as part of this small little gang of people, and so I keep track of everything about him. But one story that's been going around is Bill Clinton mad at Mark Penn. That it seems like, in a sense, that Hillary Clinton puts more faith in Penn's caution and Penn's essentially running her as a kind of independent campaign, a kind of incumbent campaign, mm-hmm. that put her at odds, put Penn at odds with Bill Clinton, although he's also tends to be at odds with the famous women of Hillary land, who tend to be a little more liberal in their orientation. So I'm surprised to hear it described as men versus women. I'm surprised to hear it described as Bill people versus Hillary.
Well, sometimes it's Hillary people versus Hillary people, Mark. Patty Solis Doyle, the national campaign manager of Hillary Clinton's, was recently dispatched to Iowa, where she's been in a squabble with Teresa Villemain, a veteran Iowa organizer who had the state operation there for Hillary Clinton. Right. And now there's an example of Hillary people going at it after each other. And then, of course, I think if Hillary loses Iowa, which is not with out the realm of possibility now, then we may see a massive turnover, Solis Doyle out, Mark Penn out, and maybe some new people in. Because there's no doubt that Hillary definitely wants to be president. I mean, that's maybe why they're running that incumbent campaign. So she'll do anything she can to get it, I think.
Well, I mean, that's what you do. I mean, there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of...
Right.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with anything you want to do and turning over your campaign. It is interesting. I mean, it's amazing how quickly things turn, because it's only a few months ago that all these, you know... And I was going crazy. I was working on, like, writing this thing about this, and I never quite did it before the tide turned, but everybody was writing this thing of, like, oh, Obama's just like Adlai Stevenson and Paul Tsongas and Gary Hart and Bill Bradley, who I work for, and they're all just, you know, beautiful losers, and they don't know how to put up a fight, and, you know, they'll just go gently into the night. And one thing about most of those people, and you can put Eugene McCarthy in that same thing, they're totally different people, which is part of the problem with it. But what most of them were trying to challenge a very established establishment candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bradley trying to get Gore, Hart against Mondale, McCarthy against, you know, Johnson at that time. And, you know, okay, they have their better educated group. And, I think the Clinton miscalculation was that they could put her in the position of that establishment candidate who would have to be brought down. You have to create the case against Gore or the case against Mondale, and it has to be really solid. And I think what's interesting here is to realize that by kind of playing it cool, by understanding that he had advantages that those previous kind of challenger candidates didn't have. You know, he had access to some of the African American vote. That educated group is larger, in fact, and, you know, the partisan base is smaller. By understanding that he had those advantages, and by understanding that, you know, people kind of wanted to vote. They want to believe he can be president. They have doubts about whether he's old enough, or, you know, they have doubts. But he didn't actually have to bring down Hillary Clinton. And I really admire the discipline by which I think they kind of understood that.
Yeah. Well,
you know, I mean, obviously you get into crazy stuff and you have opposition research offices send out memos they shouldn't send out, and that happens all the time. But that's kind of my view of Obama Clinton.
What you're getting at there, Mark, is something similar. I talk about the possible campaign staff turnover in the Clinton camp, but at the fundamental level, it is about the candidates themselves. And I think you outlined kind of the case for Obama versus the maybe a lack of a case for Clinton, or he doesn't need to make the case against Clinton as some of the other challengers toward the establishment candidate have done. I look at a parallel, and I know we'll talk about the Republicans later, but look at John McCain. Inside the Beltway, people were obsessed with the staff turnover and all the wasted money that happened in his campaign earlier in the summer. But fundamentally there, you had this dynamic where a lot of Republican voters just they don't trust John McCain. And, of course, he was on the wrong side as far as the Republican base was concerned on the immigration issue. And so I think you're right. I think sometimes we can look at, the staff turnovers. That's something that every candidate is going to do, because every candidate wants to win. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, it's about the candidate, not their staff, and not how much money they've spent.
I think that's right. I mean, they're obviously related, and sometimes what happens with a turnover is that kind of the candidate kind of takes back control of their own campaign.
Right.
And that can involve putting in somebody who knows them a lot better. I think Obama kind of turned things around when he actually brought into the campaign some people who actually knew him pretty well, because you can have a real problem when there's kind of a disconnect, when the people who are sort of speaking in your voice don't kind of bring out the best of you, which I think sometimes happened with some of Obama's speeches in particular, and kind of turned that around. And I think, you know, part of the effect of having no money and having to fire a lot of people for McCain is McCain's back to basically being McCain rather than this, whatever this crafted thing was that was supposed to, you know, appeal to Bush people and also retain the independence and be sort of more hawkish than Bush, but also, you know, be the bipartisan compromiser. I mean, there was sort of this thing cobbled together, and the staff of McCain represented that cobbling together, right?
Right, right.
I mean, there was a kind of the Mark Salter wing and the Rick Davis wing that people would sometimes talk about. Mark Salter being his Senate chief of staff, I think, and co-author on his books, and Rick Davis being his campaign manager. Mark Salter's a neocon. Rick Davis is really somebody who's looking for some kind of, you know, transcendent political deal, or, you know, kind of independent, conservative but independent. And then the other, you know, what was your impression of the Democratic debate yesterday?
Well, I actually didn't have much of an impression by it. I was so disgusted with the Republican debate the previous day that I could only barely half listen to what was going on the Democratic debate. You know, but listen, I think the one moment that I did see that I think really captured a lot of people's imagination was this now endlessly repeated question to Obama about, you know, how can you say you're a break with the past, Senator Obama, if you're relying on the advice of a lot of former Clintonites, at which point Hillary Clinton says, well, I can't wait to hear the answer to that. Yeah. And Obama actually had a great moment, I thought, when he looked to Hillary after a short pause and he said, well, Hillary, I'll be getting advice from you pretty soon, too. Yeah. This was a wonderful moment, and I think established Obama as someone who is confident in his ability to win. You know, you hear a lot about Obama, well, his heart's not really into it, or he seems, you know, like something that's said about Fred Thompson a lot. He seems almost lazy, you know. He kind of, he's a slow mover when it gets into these speeches and these campaign events. But you also hear that Obama's a strong closer. And I think that moment there, that debate, was an example of possibly this. Obama has also put out this fantastic television ad in Iowa and New Hampshire called Our Moment, America's Moment. It's a 30-second long ad, I believe. And it's very stirring. It draws from his Jefferson Jackson Day dinner speech, which is, I think, if he ends up with the nomination, that will be the date in October when people really decided, you know, he is going to be turning his campaign around. He really had a shot. So it draws from that. And, of course, the themes in that speech were drawn from his breakout speech at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, in 2004. So I think it was a strong debate for Obama, though I did notice that, you know, Fox News has been running these focus groups. And for what it's worth, which may not be that much, the focus group thought that John Edwards came out the strongest of the top three candidates. So was that your impression?
I thought Edwards, I only watched, I think I missed most of the first half hour or so of it. I thought Edwards did well. I mean, my strongest impression was that Obama was very, was exhausted. And this is exhausting. And, you know, and Hillary Clinton was not. I mean, she was kind of right on her game and obviously trying to, everybody's trying to do two, or, you know, they're trying to be senators and be candidates and this and that. All, you know, they're trying to do a million things. When you're also trying to, you know, be a minimum, you know, bare minimum level of father to two young kids, you add one more thing that creates a kind of exhaustion. So I was, you know, certainly sympathetic, and I thought the way he answered the question about his New Year's resolution was to, you know, be a better father, and, you know, you could kind of feel it. You could feel this kind of bone tiredness of what he was trying to do, and that was a reminder to me that, you know, there's a you know, Hillary experience counts for a lot in this, and energy counts for a lot in this, and you know, I'm not willing to do another, you know, straight line projection from the present of, you know, Obama zooming up and Hillary is tanking.
Absolutely.
Because she has enormous strengths, and I thought she did perfectly well yesterday. And if people begin to have any doubts about Obama, not ready, maybe he'll get savaged by the Republicans. I mean, I think if there really begin to be doubts about Obama, people very comfortably go right back to Hillary Clinton. But also, I mean, I mean, it was a very good debate for John Edwards. I have also very high energy. I thought he was fine. In a sense, it was one of those debates that to me was just very, very impressive. I was sort of actually very moved by Chris Dodd, and I've always liked Chris Dodd, and I'm from Connecticut and all that.
That's not a sentence you hear uttered often. I was moved
he's a good person, and I really liked his, you know, they asked that ridiculous question about, are you just running to, you know, to restore your father's disgraced name, which is, as a question to ask somebody after, you know, 35 years or something like that in public service, is ridiculous. But his answer, which was something about you know, I was always taught by my parents that you can change more lives through public service than through anything else, and if you're a doctor, you can change certain, you know, you can improve certain people, a set number of people's lives or something like that, but there's no other way to change, improve the lives of, you know, millions of people than public service. I thought just kind of made me proud of that whole group. And I thought Edwards was good. I think there's a certain amount of, now that it's a two-way race for, you know, in the eyes of the press and probably in the eyes of Iowa, it's never a two-way race in Iowa because people are thinking about their second choice, you know, so there's always other things going on. And at one point, John Edwards was kind of the strong second choice. You know, Hillary is almost no one's second choice. You know, and if candidates don't get 15%, you know, in an individual caucus, people can often have to use their second choice if their first choice doesn't get enough support. So, what was I going to say about that? But I think to a certain extent, Edwards seems like he's kind of being written off a little bit. I mean, there's just less belief that he's going to that he could be the nominee. And so I don't think it matters that much that he had a perfectly good debate,
right.
You know, particularly.
I think you bring up an important point, Mark, when you mentioned the second choice and the fact that in the Democratic voters' minds, Hillary Clinton is hardly ever the second choice. When you look at these Iowa polls or even the national polls, wherever, that anti-Hillary voting bloc is significantly larger than the amount of support she's gathering now. And so this makes me say, I know it. Obviously there's one or two more cycles, one or two more dynamics that are going to come into play before the voting starts, and then of course what happens in Iowa will, I believe, shape what happens in New Hampshire and beyond. But this is why I do think fundamentally Clinton's in a difficult position. Because if you're supporting one of these candidates who doesn't get to that 15% support breaking point at those caucuses on January 3rd, you're not going to go over to Hillary Clinton's corner. I can almost guarantee that. You're going to go to either Edwards or Obama's corner, and I just think that spells major trouble. You know, some people have speculated, I'm wondering what your take on this is, I've heard it speculated in Washington here that it was actually a strategic mistake for Hillary Clinton to compete in Iowa. That, in fact, if she had not, and this was a decision that was made early on, if she decided to leave the caucuses on their own, and then she could come out and try to figure out her support in New Hampshire, South Carolina, other states, that, then she wouldn't be faced in this dilemma, which places so much importance on Iowa. Does that argument, is that persuasive to you, or have you heard it before? Yeah. Or what do you think?
Well, I've always been, I mean, there was that memo suggesting that she should not compete in Iowa because it would cost so much money, which is just, it's wild to me. I don't understand that. You know, the memo said it would cost $25 million to compete in Iowa. And to me, the whole point of Iowa is it's the $2 blackjack table of American politics. That's the whole point of it. There's something I don't really understand about Iowa at this point, about how expensive it is, you know. I mean, you organize the hell out of it, and that's a lot. That is requires money, but it's actually less money than TV ads, and TV ads probably have less impact there because of the relatively small turnout of very engaged people. I think something's changed in the Iowa caucuses from what we were kind of all taught about the Iowa caucuses.
Right.
I don't think it's as liberal as it used to be. I don't think it's as union or heavy as it used to be. When I worked on the Bradley campaign in 2000, I was just, you know, it's just like, you should not be in Iowa. You should not be in Iowa. You know, you opposed ethanol. They're not going to get you're not going to get over that.
Right.
And you're not a net. There's people who are natural Iowa candidates, like Huckabee, for example, on the Republican side, and on the Democratic side, you know, Gephardt was a kind of natural Iowa candidate. I don't know it's not like you could make the argument that either Obama or Edwards is more of a natural Iowa candidate, so therefore you should stay out. I mean, Bill Clinton stayed out of Iowa in 1992 because Harkin was in the race,
right.
And Harkin's, you know, and as a result, Iowa gets written off, and that's kind of a good situation. I thought, you know, McCain made the right decision to avoid Iowa in 2000. I don't know that it would have been the right decision for Clinton this time. I mean, you know, you're supposed to be a national candidate. You shouldn't be writing off any states. It's a state that you need to show you can win in the fall. they clearly, in turning to Kerry in 2004, they clearly do put a high premium on electability and not just, you know, ideological alignment when they, you know, when they shifted from Dean to Kerry. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's a hard argument for me to make, but I also just don't understand why it costs $25 million. I mean, if it does. And it may be that people who, you know, I mean, Teresa Vilmaine has run a number of, you know, fabulous campaigns in Iowa. But there may have been changes. I mean, there may have been something that's changed there, and maybe she doesn't. Maybe they're running an old style campaign. I don't know. I mean, there's this. I've read stories that, you know, that Obama is, you know, has much more outreach in rural areas and than Clinton does. I don't know. I haven't been out there.
You know, a very trusted Republican consultant has always told me that actually TV is underrated in Iowa. The story in Iowa is always, as you say, oh, well, you need to really organize there, and it's in the, you know, soil, shoe leather politics of kind of getting all of your supporters together. But the power of television, this consultant has told me, is underrated. I did want to bring up, though, you mentioned electability and this idea that was within the Hillary Clinton campaign, certainly, that she was the most electable of the Democratic candidates. You know, what I've been puzzled about, though, however, is what conflicts with this is Barack Obama, in many conservatives' minds, and I speak now as a conservative, is actually, we have quite a soft spot for him. And we tend to like him a lot more. Now, if I were a Democrat, I would look at that and I would say, well, hold it. Wouldn't that suggest that Obama is a much more electable candidate, and that he would be able to peel off, or at least more Republican voters may be more comfortable with the idea of him being president than they would be with Hillary Clinton. And I can tell you, if there's one thing that the Republican Party is hoping for, it is a Hillary Clinton nomination,
because that
will drive Republicans to the polls on Election Day 08.
Right. I think it's, I mean, first of all, I think that the Republican affection for Obama might not last, you know, might
right.
fade. I mean, you only get one vote and you're probably going to vote for a Republican.
Right, right.
You might dislike Obama less, but your vote's going to be the same vote. And I do think that it's really, you know, it's hard. If I wanted to, like, write the memo that says here's why Obama is more electable than Hillary Clinton, I wouldn't have that much data to put in that memo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mark Penn would write a counter memo that would make the opposite case, and he'd have as much data as I'd have if that's what I was doing. Because, you know, the national polls, occasionally you'll see state polls that show a marked difference. There was a Colorado poll a couple months ago that showed Clinton doing quite poorly. But, you know, she also doesn't need to win Colorado. I think that the case that every Clinton supporter makes is, tell me how she doesn't win all the states Kerry wins, plus Ohio and or Florida and or whatever it is you have to win, New Mexico or New Hampshire, you know, a couple of the small states that were close in 2004. She probably does win all those states. Now, there's another layer of electability, which is really, which kind of came out from under the woodwork a couple weeks ago, which is, let's say Hillary Clinton says, I don't need to win Colorado. Well, what does that do when you've got massive, you know, angry Republican turnout? What does that do to your Senate, to the Democratic Senate candidate in Colorado?
Right.
What does it do to the Senate race in Kentucky? What does it do to five or six Senate races? Now, as a, you know, speaking as a liberal, I think the only thing that matters in 2009 is, do you have 52 Democrats in the Senate or do you have 57 Democrats
right.
in the Senate? If you have 57 Democrats in the Senate, you can do a lot of stuff. You
right.
can do health care.
Right.
You know, that's more important than what's in their health care plans.
Right.
And that's a bigger issue of electability. But I don't think people are calculating at that level. And even that, I'm not sure I can prove it. But if people do start thinking about electability, and once Obama, I think it'll be a wash. But it's really hard to say. I mean, people are very, very bad judges of electability.
Right.
I mean, what made people think John Kerry was more electable in 2004? You know, what do you look at and see electable? Well, you sort of see resume, you see war hero, but that's about it.
Jason Zengerle of the New Republic had that essay in New York Magazine a few weeks ago where he looked into this whole idea of electability.
I saw that. I didn't read it.
Asking what it meant. He came down to the conclusion that really it doesn't mean all that much. I think Obama has a compelling argument, though, in the general election 2008, just like I think he has a compelling argument in the primary elections, and that's this whole idea of change and breaking from the past. You know, Obama, well, this is his stated rationale for his candidacy, and when you look at the numbers, you look at the presidential approval ratings that are in the toilet, the congressional approval ratings, which are Democrats,
right,
those are in the toilet. When you look at that wrong direction number now at 70% around there for quite a sustained amount of time, this electorate really wants to move beyond something. I don't know where they want to go at the moment, but they do want to move beyond where we are now. And so I think that makes Obama actually a very dangerous general election candidate from a Republican point of view, just because he most embodies this idea of change and breaking with the past. Also a reconciliation, not only America with the world, but red America with blue America itself. Now, there's clearly a lot of arguments to be made against Barack Obama, much less the idea that he's going to raise taxes that will be brought up, this whole notion of national security in a dangerous world, though that the salience of that issue seems to be slowly fading. There's some immigration stuff that will probably be launched at him or whomever the Democrat is.
Right.
So
I think
it will be a close-run election, but I think Obama does have a solid general election message.
Oh, I think so, too. I think so, too. I only worry, I mean, the unknown is a little scary, you know.
Right.
You know what the deal is with Senator Clinton.
Right.
And I think if something happens in the course of Iowa and New Hampshire that sort of activates that feeling that people have of, like, I know what I'm getting with Senator Clinton and,
yeah,
you know, we'll go for it rather than the untested thing, that will, you know, she might be able to turn this thing around again to her advantage. To do that, of course, though, she's going to have to be negative again. And the funny thing about the situation that she created by sort of baiting Obama on, you know, where's the, every time he would, you know, be at all critical, saying where's the politics of hope, by kind of baiting that, she's now stuck in the situation where she's got to actually go much harder negative than she should.
Right.
And if it's not persuasive and it doesn't connect with people, as in things like the kindergarten memo, you know, the opposition research paper joking about, Mark Pence says it was a joke, but the opposition research paper noting that Barack Obama had written in a kindergarten essay that he wanted to be president, as response to his saying that, you know, he hadn't been planning to run for president for 20 years. I mean, if it looks clumsy and stupid, it's going to dig her hole deeper, but she does actually have to do that. She does actually have to create those doubts. And, you know, John Edwards is not going to help her create those doubts.
Right.
And I don't think there's anybody else in the Democratic field who's going to help her create those doubts about Obama. None of them are running against Obama right now.
Well, you know, it's interesting you note that Clinton is in a difficult situation. Of course, this week we had this whole specter of Obama's past drug use brought up by a surrogate of the Clinton campaign, Billy Shaheen, a very important figure in New Hampshire politics, raised this idea, perhaps even saying that Obama, if he were the Democratic candidate in the general election, he would be asked whether Obama sold drugs, you know.
Right.
And this very idea. Now, Obama has admitted to past marijuana and cocaine use when he was a youth, but never has it ever been wondered whether he was a drug dealer, which is what Shaheen was suggesting. This attack made, I think, not only a lot of Democrats angry, Obama supporters angry, but the Clinton campaign was embarrassed. Shaheen had to drop out of the campaign, his association with it. Hillary personally apologized. You know, the thing is, Mark, this is just at the moment when voters outside Washington, D.C., and those early primary states are starting to clue into the campaign. They realize that the voting is going to start pretty soon. And I think as they start to clue in, these Democratic voters, they're seeing a scared Hillary Clinton. And I don't know whether that helps her in the end. But I do want to ask you, though, we should probably switch to the other party.
This is not the first impression you want to be getting.
No, absolutely.
Everybody
exactly.
thinks they have an impression of Hillary Clinton, but when you're just tuning in, this is not what you want to be seeing.
That's right.
You want to be seeing the Hillary Clinton of 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah, the inevitable Hillary, which doesn't look to be the case anymore. But this,
let me say something, actually,
yeah,
before we switch.
Sure.
Let's say something about the incident in New Hampshire with Billy Shaheen raising the drug issue. I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, just to draw nostalgia again, when I worked for Bradley in 2000, there was a Gore. I at one point I just you know, drove up to New Hampshire, and I wound up driving Senator Bob Kerry around a lot. And there was a Gore event that was that Shaheen had organized, and we took Kerry up there to do some kind of like truth squatting, you know, hear the real facts. And this kind of gang led by Billy Shaheen chased after us and threw mud at Bob Kerry and called him a cripple. And, you know, Bob Kerry, of course, you know, actually kind of enjoys this whole thing. He gets on the phone with reporters and says, like, it's the only true thing the Gore campaign has said all year. Because he, in fact, you know, is missing part of a leg from Vietnam. So you know, the name Billy Shaheen and nasty campaign tactics is a familiar thing to me. But what's interesting about this is that somehow what's happened is, like, the issue of Obama's, you know, teenage drug use is off limits in the way that Bush's previous whatever you call it, the Bush's alcoholism is off limits.
Right.
You know, you cannot actually raise it, and it's very interesting. Phenomenon how something like that kind of gets put in this sort of off-limits space, and actually it's one of the things that makes me more confident that you can that I'm not worried about anything in the general election about Obama, because the only issue is really things you don't know about, you know, misspent youth. But if you put some of that stuff off, you know, that it's sort of not to be raised.
Right.
That's interesting.
Well, let me give you two reasons why I think that is. One, in both cases, or certainly in Obama's case, it was something that happened prior to the politicians entering public life. I think I do think political figures tend to get something of a free pass about what they've done before they run for office. Once they're in office, however, the scrutiny is high. The other thing is, Obama has always been
for a decade now, everybody gets a free pass on smoking pot, naturally.
Right.
Nobody's ever tested, can you get a free pass on having used
drugs. Sure.
You know,
I think Obama is helped by the fact that he was the one who admitted it in his book, Dreams of My Father.
Totally.
You know, that DUI, when it came out 3 days before the election in October 2000, that hurt Bush. The president himself says that now.
Right. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. No, I mean, he totally, you know, and there is no reason to be concerned about it. It's ridiculous. Now, you want to talk about the Republicans?
Sure.
Have we said all there is to be said?
I think so. We talked a lot
about
the Democrats.
We haven't covered Kucinich. We haven't covered all of them.
I know. We haven't fit Mike Gravel into the conversation, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, he seems to be gone, which is fine. Republicans, I mean, it was an interesting... the Huckabee phenomenon is an interesting thing to kind of take hold of. I mean, my read of it is I don't think Huckabee... I don't think he's electable because I don't think you want a pure social conservatism play. I mean, you need to reach pro-choice women. The Republican nominee needs some ability to reach that, you know, into the pro-choice majority in this country, which means you can be pro-life, but you need other issues, you need other things going on. Nonetheless, I think he represents the kind of, you know, I'm a big fan of Ross Douthat and Rehan Salam's Sam's Club conservatism argument, which is to basically say, you know, social conservatism should actually be paired with the kind of supports from government that families need. I think that there's an integrity to that that makes a lot more sense to me. It's not, you know, it's not my philosophy necessarily, but there's an integrity to it that makes a lot more sense than the marriage of social conservatism with economic, you know, absolute libertarianism.
Right.
So I like that Huckabee comes close to that, but I don't think that's going to work in the general election, which means I think they will, which means I think to the extent there's a Republican establishment, they're going to say, you know, we can't have this. But I do think he will make Romney just disappear. I mean, I've been amazed, you know, Romney never breaks 10% in a national poll. And Huckabee, who nobody's ever heard of him either, all of a sudden he's doing fine in national polls. And Romney does terribly in any horse race poll against a Democrat. I mean, he's the only Republican that Hillary always beats, no matter what. And so I think, and he's not a natural Iowa candidate. His Iowa lead was built on money. I mean, I think he will prove that TV isn't of that great value in Iowa because it doesn't do the things, it doesn't change the fact that, you know, you're not necessarily a good fit for that state. So, you know, I see a situation where Romney just is like John Glenn in 1984. Huckabee could win Iowa. Huckabee could, you know, I guess the scenario requires Huckabee winning Iowa, which he's on track to do. Huckabee wins Iowa. Romney's lead in New Hampshire fades, and that's it. So, you know, is there a quick effort to consolidate around Giuliani? I think the level of scandal in Giuliani is, I mean, you know, you could say every politician has skeletons in their closet. I think the level of stuff in Giuliani is enormous. I just think it's staggering. I don't really know where the Republican Party goes after that. Mm-hmm. And then I want to go back to something from the debate, but I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, you know, as Michael Barone puts it in the introduction to the new almanac on American politics, we're in an era of open field politics, right? I mean, it's a wide open, and I think nowhere is that more clear than in the Republican race for president. I wouldn't count Mitt Romney out if he loses Iowa for a few reasons. One is he's a Massachusetts Paul, and they always overperform in New Hampshire, if you recall 92.
Right, but it gets discounted for that very reason.
Well, right. Well, maybe so, but he'd still have a victory to point to. And he also has family roots in Michigan, where he's also been on the incline. There are two Republican presidential candidates whose trend lines are in an upward direction in almost every early primary state, and they're Romney and Huckabee. McCain and Thompson are both flatlining. Giuliani is burrowing down. And now this is going to change. As we said with the Democratic side, there will be one or two more cycles, I think, before the voting begins. Right. However, Romney, another reason not to count Romney out is because he has deep pockets. And he, of course, can self-finance, not only in this primary, which he has done to the tune of more than $10 million of his own money at this point, but also in the general election. And that's something that some Republican establishment types, of which you speak, may give him a second look in the end. But so I wouldn't count Romney out. I wouldn't count Huckabee out by any means, though I think he poses a lot of danger to the Republican coalition that's been successful in 6 out of the 9 last presidential elections. And so there's a reason to be wary of him. And, of course, there's also, for that same reason, because he threatens the coalition, there's reason for Republicans to be wary of Giuliani. So who does that leave? Well, I think a lot of people are going to give McCain a second look in New Hampshire. And Fred Thompson, after a strong debate, finally, this past week in Iowa, if Fred Thompson ends up in second in Iowa, I think he may be in a strong position, actually, to capitalize off what will be, I think, a very harrowing few weeks for Huckabee, should Huckabee win the Iowa caucuses.
What do you mean by a harrowing?
Well, because the scrutiny is coming. The scrutiny of Huckabee has been rising steadily since he's transferred his lead in Iowa to a lead in the Rasmussen poll in the national polls, which, as you say, is something Romney has ever been able to do. Now, as the scrutiny tightens, the screws tighten on Huckabee, he's so far been able to weather it, but I think the barrage of negative ads one is able to cut for Huckabee are just going to overwhelm him. I saw a few the other day that the Club for Growth, which, of course, the free market group pack that Huckabee dubs the Club for Greed, they don't like each other very much, and they have a very effective ad out on Fox News, using these clips, not just that one famous clip of Huckabee saying, you know, I'm fine with whichever taxes the legislature wants to raise, but, you know, getting to that tax issue, which is still very important for Republicans, then you can go after him with this Dumont stuff, the parolee, you can go after him on so many issues, including inexperience. Which would help McCain again, and Thompson, who's very serious about foreign affairs, so that doesn't really come through.
Right. No, I mean, and Thompson was pretty good in the. I mean, he was sort of there instead of just this, you know, big grumbling presence that he sometimes was. He kind of showed up, I can see that. I can see McCain being able to consolidate those gains. I mean, I think you're right about the Huckabee negatives. I mean, it's funny about the Huckabee negatives on taxes, because at the same time that he has that problem, he also, you know, is an advocate of the fair tax, which is, you know, a consumption tax, which would if he really did it, would be something like 40% added to everything you bought. And he's one of the couple who signed the Grover Norquist pledge. So it's not like with one, he has a hard time making the full Sam's Club case.
Right.
which would be, we really need to provide health care for people, and we really need to provide people the things that make families strong, because you actually can't do that if you're not willing to do anything with revenue.
Well, you almost, it almost makes you think that he really hasn't thought through some of his positions and, maybe didn't expect to be doing as well as he's doing.
I think that's right. Well, there's one theory that he's sort of running to be, I mean, there's the sort of opening of leader of Evangelical America. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, that job is open, and maybe he's running for that. I mean, Pat Robertson, in a sense, kind of won that job by running for president. Maybe he'd run it before. I don't understand the internal politics there that well, but that may be part of what he had in mind by running, more than expecting to suddenly be in the lead.
Well, let me ask you, Mark, as someone who isn't a conservative, what has fascinated you the most about the Republican race so far this year?
Well, I mean, the absence of a clear candidate is fascinating. The willingness to support Giuliani, despite a gazillion reasons not to. But the most interesting thing to me from the debate the other day was what I described as almost like the characteristic Gingrichism of the thing, which is to say, you heard all the Republican candidates, first of all, you know, we're never raising any taxes, we're cutting taxes massively, we're reducing the deficit, and then when they won't talk about any actual cuts, but, you know, we're cutting government, we're for small government, we're all this. But then they turn around and have these sort of grandiose plans, like all the questions about climate change, like, we need real public investment, we'll create jobs, it'll be a win-win for everybody, you know, all pick up the same thing on education, you know. And it kind of reminded me of that moment in 90, and I'm, you know, I'm fascinated with the whole Gingrich period, because that's when I worked on Capitol Hill and so forth. The Gingrich thing was to say, you know, we're getting rid of the Department of Education with one voice, and then with another voice he would announce, you know, we need to give every child in America a laptop computer, you know, back when laptop computers were a big deal. And this sort of characteristic, you know, massive retrenchment, that both of them are sort of done without any passion. And Gingrich at least brought some passion to the thing, but on the one hand you have this dark, you know, cut down, destroy government, tear it down, no taxes, whatever. And then you have these ridiculous, grandiose visions that are uncontested to anything. And it seems to be very different from what Bush put together, at least in the public presentation of compassionate conservatism, which was kind of small. You know, we're not going to cut back that much. We're going to have, we're going to have responsible tax cuts, and then we're going to do more for education, and we're going to, you know, but it was small bore. It wasn't huge in any direction. It was kind of something, it was presented as something you should sort of be comfortable with. I find this kind of casual, kind of swinging from one direction to the other, it just seems to me weirdly incoherent, and it seems to me a characteristic of a party that doesn't have a language for itself right now, just as it doesn't have a candidate.
See, this is why I kind of admire Fred Thompson, not only because he's displayed such contempt for this presidential pre-primary process, which is kind of admirable in a way, since he is trying to be president, but also because I think he leaves out that other half of the Gingrichian equation that you say. On the one hand, you said, you know, it's about limiting government, but always with a lot of Republican politicians, they followed up with new plans for social engineering or new subsidies or economic intervention or the like. I think that's important that you note both of those. The thing to like about Fred Thompson, if you're a conservative, is he just talks about limiting government. And he's very clear about that government shouldn't be doing a lot. He's trying to actually run, or I think maybe he is, a Calvin Coolidge for our times. You know, there was a great moment. He actually had two great moments in that debate earlier this week. One was when he refused to answer the hands down question from the moderator, which not only spoke to his contempt for the process, which I think a lot of voters are kind of like, you know, this silliness has gone on for too long, but also it got to the deep mistrust of the media distrust of the media that you have on the Republican grassroots.
Right. Well, it was also like, you know, a way of presenting himself as like, I'm a real man, and I'm gonna, you know, I'm not taking any crap from this lady here. You know, there was a little of that politics, which is part of his, you know, his his shtick has always been like he's the real man, and they're, you know, in the race.
The other good moment he had was when he said he followed that up, you know, about the question was about global warming, and he followed it up by saying, yeah, well, I have Alan Keyes' position on global warming. You know, this is not only made fun of the inclusion of Alan Keyes in this debate, which is something that no one has any idea why he was there, but also kind of showed that he really doesn't take the whole idea seriously. Not necessarily of global warming. It's hard to find out what Fred Thompson thinks about climate change, actually. But this idea that government always has to do something to solve some problem. He right. is, if you want to get to an older conservatism, kind of almost a pre-Gingrich conservatism, Fred Thompson's your man.
I guess that's right. I mean, there's a kind of classic. I mean, he is more engaged with the issues than any of the others.
True.
I mean, he's actually trying to be a little more substantive. You know, Romney has some of it, but it isn't much. There's a little more there, but it's kind of 90s stuff. It's like entitlements are the problem. Cut entitlements. I mean, it's kind of stuff he learned during that period that he was in the Senate. And I think you're right. It's a little more old fashioned. Language, you know, I guess you're right. I mean, he has none of the grandiosity and incoherence. Alan Keyes, you know, I'd forgotten he was in the race. So I was surprised he was there, but you know, I mean, talk about a guy who has his voice. I mean, that was my feeling through this whole debate was nobody here really has a voice. They don't really have what I think Obama, Edwards, and Clinton all have, which is a real theory of change and how we're going to do things in this country and how we're going to move forward. And I don't agree with all of them, but they're kind of rich and complete visions. And I'd say the same of Dodd and Edwards, of Dodd and Biden. But I didn't think any of the Republicans really have that. And Keyes does. I mean, he is what he is. I'm not sure why you should object to him being there. I actually think Kucinich should have been. Kucinich represents an alternate viewpoint within the Democratic universe in a way that Gravel does not. I thought Kucinich should be included in the Democratic debate, and you know, didn't bother me that Keyes was included in the.
Here's the difference, though. Dennis Kucinich, a powerful player in Iowa politics, actually has significant support. Alan Keyes has no presidential campaign and has no support. He announced several months ago he's been included in only one debate prior to this, which was the PBS debate dealing with African-American issues. And by the Des Moines Register's own criteria by which candidates were included, the criteria by which the Des Moines Register left out Kucinich and Gravel from the Democratic debate, Keyes should not have been included. He has no staff in Iowa. He polled 1%, which is a statistical anomaly in the November poll of the Des Moines Register, but he polled 0% in the October Des Moines Register poll. So, you know, this is a very interesting question of why he was there. There was some speculation in Washington that he may have been a surrogate meant to attack another candidate. I thought it interesting, though, that he attacked Mitt Romney most vehemently, went after him on the life issue, and of course also went after Giuliani. So it doesn't seem like he was acting as a surrogate for anybody. Right. I think he just liked the opportunity to explain his vision of America.
Right. Well, since while we're on the topic of Alan Keyes, let's wrap this up with one.
Sure.
You posted an item today about Charles Krauthammer's column about religion in politics, which was basically arguing that this idea has emerged, you know, very explicitly in Romney's speech, that you know, not only is it valid for religion to be the source of one's, you know, social commitments and beliefs, but that it's, you know, that it's desirable that it be, and that's the place of religion in public life, and that they're all the Republican candidates are kind of being pressed towards a view of religion which is, you know, very alien to the founders, and I noted this with interest because. You know, it's been many years since I read a Charles Krauthammer column that I agreed with. So it's kind of you know, something's misaligned with the planets. It's like, you know, beginning of the scene in Ghostbusters where the guy says, you know, dogs and cats sleeping together. That I'm, you know, a little worried about what's going on in the world, but I thought it was a good point, and maybe you can say a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Krauthammer I think, hit on something important, which is, you know, there's a distinction to be made between the establishment of religion, which the Constitution, you know, forbids, and which guarantees religious freedom, rather the Bill of Rights forbids, and then also the religious test, which is contained within the Constitution, which says there will be no religious test for executive office or for any office. You know, and what we see in some of these candidates on the Republican side, and specifically Huckabee and Romney, is almost a subversion of that second part. They're not going for the establishment part, but they're going, they're slightly subverting the idea of religious tests. And of course, the irony is that Romney, by arguing against a religious test, by which he may be viewed as unacceptable because of his Mormonism, has also imposed a religious test of his own, which is this suggestion that freedom is just as dependent on religion as religion is dependent on freedom. This idea that if you have no religion, then perhaps you don't have any freedom. Now, Krauthammer exposed this as a fallacy. He says, well, if there's any, you know, Romney mentioned that the churches in Europe are going pretty much empty these days, though there is a slight revival. But of course, Europe is probably one of the most permissive and free places on earth. So, you know, there you have freedom without religion pretty easily. And of course, there are places, not large swaths of the world, but if you look at the Taliban's version of governments in Afghanistan, I mean, there is a case where you have plenty of freedom. You have plenty of religion, but absolutely no freedom. So I thought it was an effective Krauthammer column, and I was also, what disturbed me most, actually, about the Romney speech was his writing out of Thomas Jefferson from the founding of the American Republic. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, I would say, pretty important figure in American history. And, of course, Jefferson was a deist. He believed in God, but he believed in God the Watchmaker, someone who had left... you know, had left and moved on to probably more interesting things. And by Romney's criteria, then maybe there might not be a place for Jefferson in public life.
Right, right. Well, of course, I think of Romney as so callow that it's not like I believe that speech represents what Romney believed. It's just like to salvage his candidacy, he needs to set up a scenario where it's like, it's not like me, the Mormon, versus you, evangelicals. Right. It's, you know, it's you and me against those godless atheists over there. And, you know, he probably doesn't actually care that much about atheists. I mean, I don't know what he really believes. So, but it was a very disturbing speech. And I say that as somebody who has, you know, is not particularly religious, but I have no discomfort with people coming to public issues from, you know, with their religion at their roots, as Obama does, and as many, many people do. I thought that was, I mean, I don't know, but I don't know. Does anybody in Republican politics care? I mean, are there many Republicans who were creeped out by Romney's presentation there or by Huckabee?
No, I don't think there are many Republicans who kind of have the same concerns as a Krauthammer or I have those concerns or you have those concerns, though you're obviously not a Republican. You know, what's fascinating, one last dynamic we might want to hit on before we wind this down is, you know, there is a sharp division within conservative circles about Mike Huckabee. You have Republican elites who are typically coastal, people like Krauthammer, people like even Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, who lives in New York City, others who are very wary of Mike Huckabee and what he represents, whereas, of course, it seems the Republican grassroots are very supportive of Huckabee, and in fact, although all this bad news has been coming out, you still haven't seen a tick down in his support.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, he's scandal or this issue with Wayne Dumont, the fellow whose sentence he led to be reduced to, terrible, you know, real monster rapist and murderer, and because one of his many victims was a, you know, eighth cousin of Bill Clinton, they kind of convinced themselves that he'd been railroaded by Bill Clinton. To me, it's unbelievable. It's like a reminder of how crazy people made themselves over Clinton stuff. But it also has this sort of, you know, it's a real reminder of that there is this sort of weird backwoods quality. I mean, it makes him seem like not somebody who's, you know, is operating in a really rural politics, not somebody who you can imagine as a national figure.
Right.
I guess. I mean, there are a lot of things about
that. We may be surprised.
You never know. Yeah. You want to? I'm tempted to, you want to end with some predictions, or you want to just leave that for a...
Well, you know, I...
You know, you could use the Barone prediction, you know, many things may happen, open field politics.
No, I really, you know, I mean, in past years, that's been a cop-out, but I actually think in this case, it's absolutely true. I really don't know what way it's going to go on the Republican side, but I can tell you, Mark... This is the time to buy Obama. I'm trying to keep hope alive here. I say buy Obama.
Well, I already bought
now.
Obama. I 6 or 8 months ago, I made a bet with a colleague of mine here that Hillary Clinton would not win a single primary.
Wow.
I bet him lunch.
Wow.
And in most of the time since then, I mean, you know, it's I can buy him lunch. It's no big deal. So, but in the past, I've been sort of like, I'll pay that bet now. I'll buy you lunch now. And the other, yesterday, he came to me and said, you know, I might owe you lunch.
Nice.
So, we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
Nice to talk to you, Matt.
Nice to talk to you.
Let's do this again. Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.